somewhere in that ancient mystic trinity, you'll get three. It's the magic number.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Tell me if you heard this one. An artist, an art critic, and a museum director walk into a recording studio. No, it's not a joke. This actually happened. Twice. Last season, we sat down with three experts from different parts of the art world for a discussion with plenty of digressions. Now we're getting the band back together. Same as last time, the roster includes Hrog Vartanian, editor of the popular arts and culture website Hyperallergic, Philbrook director Scott Stulen, and artist Sharon Loudon, who is currently putting the finishing touches on a brand new installation in the Philbrook Rotunda. Loudon's installation will be on view through the rest of 2019. So, before we get too far into this, I want to make sure everyone has a moment to ID themselves. So let's start with Sharon. Hello, Sharon.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yes. We also have Hrog here with us from Hyperallergic.
Hi.
And then back again. We can't keep him away. This is like when Neil Young joins Crosby, Stills, and Nash. We have our director, Scott Stulen.
That's how exactly I'm referring to myself. I am the Neil Young.
You pop in and out. You play when you want to.
I do. Yeah. And sometimes I'm just solo. It's fine.
Yeah. Sometimes you're with Crazy Horse. Okay, so we're glad to have you back. So Hrog and Sharon, you were here as part of our first season. We did an episode called Ask the Experts, and we talked about all kinds of different things, kind of looking back at how you got into the work you're doing. But today, we're going to pretend like everyone's listened to that episode already. And if they haven't, they certainly can go do that. So spoiler alert or something, you can go listen to that now. That was episode 3 of season 1 of Museum Confidential. But we have this interesting mix here. So we have a museum director, we have an artist, Sharon, and then we have an art critic with Hrog here. So we have kind of all different sides of this experience. So I wanted to talk about where we are as museums, and meaning more broadly, and where we're going. And I wanted to begin with the concept of the blockbuster show, because I think if you trace things back to, let's at least go back to the Alexander McQueen show. That seems like it was a moment when things really took an interesting turn. So the Metropolitan Museum, for people that don't know, did an exhibition of the fashion designer Alexander McQueen not long after he committed suicide. And it was this massive cultural thing where people were lined up for, you know, blocks around the museum. And it kind of brought on the concept of fashion exhibitions. There had been some before, but there's been so many things since then. And since then, you've seen a lot of these kind of big happenings that are kind of this interesting mix of pop culture versus the traditional museum show. One that's been recently interesting is this David Bowie exhibition that has been at the MCA Chicago and the Brooklyn Museum. Where are we when we're kind of dealing with things like that? I'll throw this to Hrog to kind of start with this. Mm-hmm. Where are we in terms of kind of the hierarchy of the big museum shows?
Well, you know, I feel like we're going back to the origin of like Western museums. I mean, these blockbusters are not new. I mean, they were the salons of their time, mm-hmm. you know, meaning like these were social events where the majority of people aren't just quote unquote art people. They're people who want to share an experience with other people. And I think with the popularity of museums, and I think the fact that museums are changing, I mean, so the blockbuster now is just become sometimes an excuse to bring in those other people. And in a way that, you know, people don't want to go and see an artist necessarily they've never heard of. I mean, something that's unfamiliar can sometimes, you know, discourage people because they want to know what to expect. Kind of like, you know, a TV show that you know what you're going to expect every week or something. And it's kind of similar. The blockbusters become those. They're kind of almost like give people an opportunity to come in and like almost show their allegiance to an institution and just to the idea of art sometimes, you know? And I think blockbusters are those moments where you can do stuff like that.
Do you think it's kind of like for the industry, kind of a what retail thinks of as a loss leader in a certain sense? Not that they're losing. Obviously, people make a lot of money, but the idea is to have this thing that's a major draw that then you can maybe highlight other parts of the institution because these people aren't there in the first place.
Yes, but I also think they're kind of can be really great by themselves. I mean, they can have a lot of research. They can push people who normally are working in sort of Ivy Towers into like trying to engage with a big audience and a public. And, you know, and also, they get bodies through the door. Memberships often go up with blockbusters. You know, these are the practical concerns that people often worry about. And also companies love to put their names on things like that. You know, it's like, you know, and so sponsors like that too. But the other thing is, it's also in our culture, it's a way of signaling to people outside. So people are going to wear the T-shirt of the, you know, Monet show or the Van Gogh tote bag. And so it's also a way of the museum pushing their presence outside of the museum too.
Well, Sharon, as an artist, Harag just mentioned this thing that a lot of people don't want to go see an artist who they don't know. And of course, most artists are people that don't have name recognition, the vast majority. So if you kind of have this top of the line thing where you have this Sgt. Pepper's album cover of only the artists that people want to go see, but then, you know, thousands and thousands of people that are doing great work right now that might not be the draw. What is that balance that museums need to strike versus kind of giving people what they want versus debuting new important voices?
I don't think it's either or. I think you can have context. You can have someone who's recognized with somebody who isn't as much and to bring recognition to that person as a bridge. But I also think it's just to the Brooklyn Museum and the museums showing Bowie. And then when you were talking about McQueen, it's very interesting to me that the museum takes advantage of somebody who died to then do it shortly after their death. It's a little creepy and takes advantage of the public feeling sad about the loss of David Bowie to be able to come in and gain revenue. I mean, that creeps me out.
Opportunism.
Oh, totally. I mean, in some ways, people, I guess they wouldn't apologize for that, but I find that to be incredibly uncomfortable that they would take advantage of that. So in the normal year, I guess, of programming, to be able to, aside from that, to be able to balance that out, to have that context, it's really interesting. And it's true to be able to have somebody who is recognized to sort of offset more costs, the cost for people who aren't, unfortunately. But I do think museums, they have an obligation to show people from the 99%.
Scott, have you seen any shows that are kind of focused on a big name artist that the curators then incorporate contemporary artists or other artists that are lesser known to draw comparisons or show similarities and styles over time?
I think that happens frequently. I mean, a lot of thematic shows do that, where you have some anchors, which are some well-known artists, and then you kind of incorporate some lesser-known artists. And they could be artists from, you know, centuries ago, but also contemporary artists with that, too, to try to introduce people to new artists. I think that's also thinking about a thematic show, too, as a way of introducing. So maybe the names of the artists isn't the draw, but the theme is something that people can really get excited about. So that's another approach, you know, to doing that. And, you know, I think to the blockbuster thing from the museum perspective, there's a certain drug that comes to that, too, where this it becomes kind of this trap. Like, how do you outdo the Bowie show then? Because the next one needs to do a little bit more because there's so much of the attendance and revenue attached to it. It's how do you keep pushing that? And it's really hard to do that. You create these attendance and revenue spikes. And I think from my perspective, the hope is that you can really integrate things being artists that are maybe not those names and getting people really excited about your permanent collection as much as they are about the traveling shows that are coming through. So it really is, as Sharon said, it's about that balance.
So it sounds like you're saying something kind of more of the tortoise and the hare model, yeah. You know, kind of winning the race by continually growing, doing more interesting things, as opposed to kind of having these giant highs and low points.
Well, part of my approach, at least with Philbrook, is how do you make the everyday experience be compelling? So it isn't just coming once every 3 to 4 years for the blockbuster, and I'll see you again when you do another one like that. Mm-hmm. But how do you come once a month? Because today I'm going to check out that part of the gallery that I haven't been in some time, and maybe I'll discover something new about the collection. Another time I come to go to the restaurant. Another time I'm coming to see a film. Sometime I'm just coming to meet my friends there. But I think all of those things happening at the museum, and that's why looking at amenities and some of the other things that wrap around the art is equally important.
Sharon, you mentioned something a moment ago about the 99%, right?
Yes.
And it's interesting, this idea that was so connected to economic issues. Those phrases have become embedded in the popular culture, the 1%, the 99%. When you're talking about that in terms of the art world and museums, what exactly do you mean by that?
For me, as an advocate for artists and as an artist, it's the people who aren't being shown as much, the people who aren't getting access to having their work out there in any form. I think that there has to be more of that. It has to be the 99% of artists. There's so many artists who don't have any presence in museums in this country. And I think that museums have to step up to open those doors for the 99%. And we talked about that in the last podcast that we did.
This episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by the Water Fountain. Friends, has staring at all that art got you feeling parched? Has puzzling over the implications, the ideas, or the imagery of a certain creative work left you as dry as a bone, as arid as a desert, or otherwise? If so, remember the Water Fountain, usually located near the restroom and always refreshing in the most literal sense. The Water Fountain will quench your thirst, clear your head, invigorate your throat, and immediately facilitate the passage of that medication you forgot to take. It's like the Greeks and Romans used to say, life is short and art is long, so stay hydrated.
Harag, how many museums do you think you visit in a year? You know, we're talking dozens.
Different museums?
Yeah, different museums.
Museum visits
or galleries. Let's count galleries.
Oh, then definitely hundreds.
Yeah, so it's something.
We're definitely in the hundreds.
And so I want to start a new segment. This is called Museum Pet Peeves. It's a new segment. And this
okay, I am so here for this.
How much time do you have?
I am too, right? How long is this for?
Is this a listicle? Because I think I might have one somewhere.
Yeah.
I want to, without naming names, we're not going to.
One all name.
Okay.
I'm fine
all right.
With that.
Yeah.
I would too.
Yeah, yeah. You want to name some names? All
yeah,
right. Let's do it. You know, we don't have to go through 100 things, but you walk into a museum and X drives you insane. What are those things that ruin the experience from the get-go?
Ooh, I mean, I think one of the big pet peeves I have is when museums give really strange, a disproportionate amount of space to things that make no sense. Do you know? And it's like, and I feel like there's so many museums that are like, I feel like 90% hallway and 10% gallery. And that's where it's like, you're like, what, who thought this was a good idea? Do you know? It's like, what is this for? The school group with a bunch of kids so they don't touch things? Or like, you know, and that's like the worst kind of experience.
Is that because someone's trying to manufacture gravitas?
Perhaps. Perhaps it's also just that it looked really cool in the design, and conceptually people can't visualize how the space is going to work.
Now, does any place come to mind? You said you were going to name some names.
Well, in that one, let me think. I mean, I'll tell you MoMA is an example. The Museum of Modern Art in New York, it feels all airport and like, you know, 20% galleries half the time. And you're just like, this is really, you know, as opposed to, let's say, the Metropolitan Museum. It doesn't feel like all hallway. There's art everywhere. You know, it's kind of used in a way that's much more efficient, really, as an art viewing, as opposed to me going, oh, I have to travel to that gallery all the way there and go through this transient space, you know, and spare me.
All right. Museum pet peeves. Sharon. Oh,
so the first thing I thought of was MoMA, too. I hate the fact that they took away their whole project room exhibitions because they only really show blue chip artists or artists that show in galleries. So I think that that's terrible. I also don't like the lack of transparency. Like, they're not directors and curators' email addresses on their websites, so there's no access. Artists can't reach those people at all or can't work with them. And it seems like, especially MoMA, they're on their own island. Like, when I walk in there, I feel like I have to maybe dress up to be in that place. I don't feel like it's very welcoming at all. I don't feel like the art is accessible by the conditions that they've set up. Online, also their programming, it's very elitist. It's really only for the 1%. And they also make a tremendous amount of money from their entry fees, I would imagine, because it's so high. So I'd like to see the entry fees go down too.
Do you think that one of the reasons, that's an interesting point that you brought up, the idea that the staff of a museum or the people who are kind of the experts, the curators, aren't accessible to the public.
Right.
Do you think that's because, and I know on our website, we have a staff directory and you can see who does what job and all these things. It makes me think of it like a magazine, you know, a magazine like The New Yorker, for example, has always been very kind of cagey about the masthead. You can't even really find like a list of the staff writers and all these things. Part of that, you know, is always, and a lot of that's changed now. You can submit a poem or you can do things. Do you think that's because museums are so inundated with unsolicited asks?
Yes, I totally.
And how do you balance that? Because you do need to be able to like keep working and not be overwhelmed with things, right?
But you know, Museum of Modern Art actually has a policy. If you send them art, they will destroy it.
I understand that.
Do you know they don't return, like as an example. So they have some really harsh policies.
I think, first of all, and this is going to sound really corny and cliche, but there's truth in this. Without artists and the art, they would not exist. Okay, and they have a responsibility to their community. If those
and we're talking about museums generally, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, all museums. I also think if they're opening their doors to the public, they have to have a level of transparency. There's a lot of opacity with Museum of Modern Art and some other museums that are in this country. I do agree that it's to prevent them from being inundated. But how about doing something a little different? How about opening that door? And if artists don't really understand, I understand artists have to do the work too. They have to be able to understand how to communicate with the museum and think of the other person. I totally get that. But how about if the museum just responds and says, I'm sorry, we cannot take this at this time, or have some kind of dialogue as they welcome from the public who come in and pay that entry fee to see the work. So I just think that there has to be that transparency. It's a huge pet peeve of mine. Because then it means that they just block all access. And that's a lot of symbology, too. It's like, we don't want you in here.
So they kind of, this goes to Scott. We at Philbrook get lots of emails about artists wanting, local artists or regional artists wanting to show their work. We get a lot of emails about appraisal and all the things that kind of come through the, you know, over the transom, you know, the digital transom. And I wonder, and it does take time to respond to those things and you know, all that. Do you see a value in running an institution having that kind of transparency?
You have to have that transparency. It's our job. My email is sstulen@philbrook.org. There you go. You need to have that. It's our job. And we need to be accessible. We need to be communicating with the community. And all of those questions that come up, that's partly one of the services that we provide. It's really important to do that. And I think particularly for local artists. And one of my pet peeves is museums that feel like they're not at all connected to their local artist community, like they're not for that. I mean, that is one of your main audiences that you need to be for. It doesn't mean you have to show every artist that wants to show there. But for the most part, what artists want to use is the museum as that resource and also a place that you want them to gather. So I think that it's vital to be transparent.
How do you find that balance if that's the case and museums are engaging more with their local audience, whether that's in New York or Scranton or Tulsa or Walla Walla, Washington, wherever that is? How do you do that and maintain, I'll throw this to Harag, how do you do that and maintain the perception that museums are different than galleries, right? Mm-hmm. And that there is a hierarchy to the art world, meaning a gallery, a for-profit commercial gallery that sells work is always going to be a different space for showing things rather than a museum, which is a...
Yeah, but those lines are blurring.
So talk about
that. You know,
that's
part of it. I mean, yeah, we're talking about a public. I mean, if you're a public museum, you've got to engage with the public. And I think so for too long, we've been not expecting that, you know? And I think that's where it's like, we got to demand it. I mean, this is what's going on at the Brooklyn Museum in the last how many months or a year or whatever, and a lot of other institutions where people are like, hey, we are the public. You know, we get to speak up and say, this is what we want, or this is what we need, or we don't agree with this. You know, and it's like, because it is blurring. And the reality is that even public institutions are often serving very private, opaque interests. And that's a problem. I think it should be something that we all scrutinize very, very closely. Now, galleries, at the end of the day, yes, they're commercial and they're very different. But, you know, frankly, they're part of the ecosystem. And sadly, some museums are being instrumentalized to, like, you know, serve the needs of galleries because they are often supplementing and paying for shows or shipping and this type of thing. So, you know, we've got to think of it holistically. This is a big ecosystem. So museums are just part of it. They're not the pinnacle necessarily anymore that they may have been, or at least we treat them on. Because the other question is, who are we saving these objects for?
It's an interesting question because when you think about the big kind of top tier galleries, of course, Gagosian, for example, they're seen on, I think, to the, and many people on the same level as museums. You know, they're showing
Manzoni
things.
Show.
Yeah, I mean,
Piero Manzoni show at the Gagosian years ago was a museum show.
Yeah.
I mean, probably better than any Piero Manzoni show I'd ever seen.
Or if you think about the Castelli Gallery of the past, you know, and places like that, there were these blurred lines because they were showing the big artists of the day in, the, in those spaces. To that point, and Scott, you did not do a pet peeve. We need to throw in a pet peeve.
I'll do a pet peeve. Security guards that are like all over you.
Yeah.
Museum shops that you can't get basic things like aspirin and like sunscreen.
museum gift shops yes. as bodega. Yeah.
Yes. And like someone's like the thing you actually need because your kid's melting down. Can I please buy a cookie?
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. Things like that. Labels that are like a mile long and actually don't offer any more insight into the work.
You're saying you like those.
I do not like those. Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, there's many things like that, but I think I agree with some of it. And the other one I will say is that particularly with more contemporary museums is when the architecture gets completely in the way of the art.
Yeah.
Sharon, to the point of having this transparency where there's a stronger umbilical cord between artists and institutions, artists probably make mistakes all the time about approaching these places. And if you have, it's like a date, right? If you have a bad first impression, some artist emails you and you're a curator at XYZ Museum. Yep. If it's not a good experience that first time, you're not going on another date with that person.
Right.
So how should, if there's an artist listening and they're saying, I want to be in this museum or I have aspirations to get to that place, what is the path to get your art into a museum writ large, if there is one?
It's really complicated because they're all different artists, right? I think the first thing is that the artist has to find their fit, meaning they have to find the museum or institution or a gallery, whatever, whoever they want to connect with, someone that fits their work. Make a determination who speaks their same language. And then what I like to do is start a relationship. That might mean just putting somebody on your mailing list and send them an announcement of an exhibition. Or reaching out and saying, hello, I love what you're doing, your vision, et cetera. I just want to introduce my work to you. And not ask for anything, necessarily. Create a reason, too, to be able to approach someone. Like, for example, if you say, I would like to invite you to something, maybe to an open studio. And even if, let's say, they want to connect with somebody in Dubai, for example, and an exhibition is in Tulsa, do it anyway, because it puts the artist on their radar, the person they're trying to contact. And they, at least that person from Dubai can look at their website and can be introduced to their work. It becomes like an excuse to connect. I just think it's like building any relationship. I mean, most of the relationships I've built are from cold calls, meaning without referrals, in this way, 80% of them. And I actually haven't been, as an artist, I haven't benefited from hardly any referrals, actually. And if they are, they came a lot from artists, from our own community and connecting people to one another. And that's the other thing, is build your community so you can support one another so that artists can introduce other artists to other people, so to make that entry a little easier.
We've spent a lot of time kind of saying things we don't like and things that kind of drive us crazy, but I'd be curious to know from all three of you, Harag, starting with you, what makes you super optimistic about the art world right now? Like, what makes you glad to be doing what you're doing?
It makes me really happy to see institutions that are actually dealing with some messy questions, to be quite honest. I'm excited about that. I think museums have a huge ability to like tackle these things. You know, it's messy. And we don't have, talk about the erosion of public space in our cities and our places we live. Museums are becoming one of our only public spaces, especially now that all malls are dying, even though they've all been private. You know, but it's like, think of it. It's like
libraries aren't what they used to be. Libraries,
right, exactly.
Libraries are changing, but it's like, where can you actually meet people, right? Mm-hmm. And museums is a place that we sort of go ritually to kind of like, you know, enact our cultural lives, right? Right. And so it's like, how can we bring people there? And it's like museums have that ability now to, like, you know, engage with political issues, economic issues, education issues, all these things, you know, one after the other. And it's like, and you know what? It's great, because what makes them unique, partly, it's because they appeal to a certain elite in a place, because they have their ear, which is a huge issue. You have a creative population that uses it to feed their own creativity. You have a public that somehow feels they have no access to these things that otherwise feel like they would never, they can't go to Italy, they can't go to China, they can't go to these places. They can enact those lives and those possibilities in this place close to home. I mean, think about it. There are very few places where those things happen, where you can stand beside someone who is a millionaire who might be collecting art, and then on your other side, a school kid that doesn't know anything about Renaissance, you know, and you're like sitting there and you're sandwiched between them, and you're sort of like, wow, we're looking at the same object. We have a common experience. And at the end of the day, culture is about sharing those common experiences, right? That's our frame of reference.
Scott, what gets you excited? You know, time to make the donuts kind of stuff.
It's about actually being able to impact people, and art does that. For me, that is to be able to put that in a position to connect people to art and culture. And for me, that is incredibly important. But also to have that very unique opportunity to be able to do that. And to be able to do that to more and more people, I think it's opening up the museum so it doesn't feel like an elitist kind of like a country club, but something really is more like your, you know, town square, the thing the malls used to be. And I think museums are a unique place, just off of what Rog was saying, is that where you can have that school kid and the retiree and, you know, the construction worker and the art historian all in the same space. And there's so few spaces where that happens in the same place. And, you know, for me, it's those little moments, too. So recently we were at an event, and I overheard this, is this five-year-old kid was having a meltdown with his mom because he didn't want to leave the museum. And his mom whispered over and said, it's like, it's okay, we got a membership tonight. We can come anytime we want now. And for me, that will give me fuel for months.
Yeah, you know, a while back, the museum had a, museums have school field trips and tours all the time. That's kind of the, you know, the special sauce of museums that kind of makes everything come together. But I went down to one of the studios one day, and there was a field trip from the Oklahoma School for the Blind. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole group of blind children, and they were making art. And so the question was, well, how do blind children make art? Well, the studio assistants and art educators gave them paints, and each color had a different texture to it. So they may not know blue, red, yellow, green, but each one felt different. So they could at least compose something that is a diversity of textures, and who knows what would come of that. But to be in that room and to see these kids doing that, I mean, that kind of says everything, you know, about why we do what we do. Sharon, what makes you, you know, just kind of want to be doing this for the rest of your life, you know, other than just having the call to be an artist? But you do so much more than that. You're an advocate for so many things. You know, why do you not just want to sit around and make your own art, but you also want to help other people do things too?
I love my community. I mean, I love my community. I love creating impact. I love feeling that there's purpose. We have a short life. So,
did you have a Sharon Loudon in your life who helped you what you do?
My high school teacher. I went to a public high school, and she really believed in me. And Mary Bloom, who lives in Alaska. And she really did a lot for me to give me that faith to go forward. But I also think it's resistance, too, resistance against people who stop me from doing things. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of fuel in my body to keep going against those people, to be able to show that artists can do many things. But I just want to answer your question about the optimism of museums, too. I just want to say one thing about it, too, just reiterating what these guys said here. But also, museums provide possibilities. At least I feel like they do. And they also provide safe places for artists to be able to feel that we have that validation, that there's a place where we can work towards but feel like we can be included in. And also the possibility for sanctuary. There's still possibility that that can happen across the whole world, that museums can provide so much. And what's so great about museums right now is they have opportunity to do so much. They just have to take it. I'm thinking also about not only Scott running this museum, but also Jill Schneider at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Cleveland, and also Franklin Sermons, shout out to him at the Perez. It's really about the person at the top, like any other business, right, that set the tone. and to show that there is open access, there is inclusivity. And that feeling of being in a museum, there's nothing like it when you have that feeling of those possibilities and that inclusivity. It feels wonderful, especially for artists. We want to continue to make work and contribute to that conversation.
In 2012, not long after opening its doors to the public, the Perot Museum of Nature and Science in Dallas, Texas, had an incident. On December 30th, in an area of the museum known as Sports Hall, a man was injured while taking part in an interactive exhibit called Jump. After being pressed for more details by local media for several days, museum officials finally acknowledged that an adult male had suffered a, quote, non-threatening injury, and that the exhibit in question would be temporarily closed. After even more outside pressure, the, quote, non-threatening injury was discovered to be a severed finger. Not merely severed, but ripped off. The Dallas ABC affiliate WFAA caught up with the injured party, revealing him to be an engineer from Juarez, Mexico named Luis Martos Uribe. My pain was that my daughter saw what happened to me, he told WFAA, so I grabbed my finger and ran to get help so she wouldn't see me. According to a report in the Dallas Observer, the man later spent $40,000 in a failed attempt to save the finger. He promised to take legal action. No lawsuit was ever filed. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.